doesn't tell you anything about the migration into rich countries, which is what this article is all about.
Because it shows in a relatively small area of this world how important these corporations are.
We should strongly discourage irregular migration through working with partners, and we should encourage people who need protection.
Zwei plus zwei ist vier, der Europa-Podcast mit Gerald Knaus und Philipp Sandmann. Jetzt.
Welcome to yet another special edition of our podcast in which Gerald Knaus and myself, Philipp Sandmann, talk about migration in the context of Europe and in the context of making political decisions that actually lead to an optimal outcome on many different levels. In our last episode in English, we talked about Emmanuel Macron's state visit to the UK, which happened last week and was somewhat historic, apart from niceties that were shared and some humor from Macron.
However, I have to confess that we love monarchy, but especially when it's not at home.
There were also some pretty important and wide-ranging political decisions, which we shall discuss in today's episode. Namely, of course, a major deal between the two countries to tackle illegal channel crossings from France to the UK, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But the second big topic, and this will be our first topic, actually, of today's episode, is the Economist headline, which reads, "Scrap the asylum system and build something better. Rich countries need to separate asylum from labor migration." This is a headline which The Economist published recently. I think it's the current, most recent Economist print version out there. And I mean, this is sort of a controversial headline, if you will, Gerald. So I'd like to get your view on this. Is the general idea to scrap the asylum system a good one because, in fact, many things of the asylum system are failing, or is it the wrong direction to take? What's your view?
Yes. Hello. Good morning, Philip. Nice to talk again. I was struck by this article because it's very much in the style of The Economist, very provocative. Scrap the system. You know, there is an obvious solution. Then, of course, an interesting recommendation at the end. I'm sure we get to it, which is not that far from what my colleagues and myself have been recommending. But the bulk of the analysis and the title, I find quite misleading and not very serious, but it reflects a lot of what is out there in the debate, and perhaps it's useful to analyze it a little bit. What is it that I think is misleading about the picture, which concludes, and that is definitely true, that the current system of asylum globally doesn't work? What's the problem? Now, let me start with one very simple observation. The article says that rich countries, in fact, all countries, but it focuses on its readers in Europe and North America, should separate asylum from labor migration. Well, that's, of course, that's the point of having an asylum system. That if somebody comes, you can assess, do they qualify for protection? It then says, yes, but there is no support to give protection to a large number of people who just turn up at our borders. Wouldn't it be nicer if people just stay away, go elsewhere? You know, ideally to the country next door, close by is the formulation, which makes a lot of sense. And then the article says most people who are displaced, in fact, never leave their country. They are internally displaced, or indeed they go to a neighboring country. And then it throws into two numbers. And this is where it gets really misleading. It throws in the number of a huge number of internally or internally displaced or refugees.
So this is the 900 million number?
Or? That's the more than 120 million. And it says those are people forcibly displaced in the world. And then it says, well, obviously, we European countries, America, will not take in more than 120 million. I get to that number in a second. But the other one that you refer to now is even more misleading. It talks about 900 million people in the world. This was a survey by Gallup, would like to migrate. And then it comes from that huge number, 900 million, to the very obvious point that if those 900 million people would suddenly turn up, let's say in Europe, and claim asylum, well, our political system would reject this. Majorities would say we will not accept hundreds of millions of people. And so it suggests that there is a huge pressure. It's this image of migration pressure, a huge pressure of people who want to migrate, and then they might be tempted to take the irregular or illegal route and then arrive as irregular migrants and then claim asylum. And that is the crisis of the asylum system. I mean, that's the claim. We cannot cope. It's too big. It also rightly says that most countries in the world do not give protection, do not make asylum determination. It refers to China. That's not new. That's been the case for decades. But that's true. And we wrote about this as the Asian asylum desert, that in Asia, where almost half of humanity lives, neither Japan, nor China, nor South Korea, nor Indonesia, nor Malaysia give protection.
Yeah.
Okay, but what's wrong about the 900 million people? And I think this is such a fundamental point because this is what creates a lot of fears. When Gallup asks people, do you want to migrate? And then people say yes. We know from all the research in last decades, this is almost no indication for what actually happens. Let me show you. In that Gallup poll, it said that 17% of EU citizens want to migrate. And as we know in the EU, there's this unique situation where if you want to migrate to work, to study, you can. Uh-huh. I mean, you can. If you're Greek, you want to work in Germany, you can go to Germany and work or to study in France. Or in the EU, 17%. Would be around 77 million people. But after decades of free movement, only 14 million Europeans live in another EU member state. I mean, it's just not true. I mean, people might say we want to migrate, but they don't. Even in a place where there's zero risk, it's very easy. You have a legal right. But it's even more stark with Africa, sub-Sahara Africa. Because this is, of course, what people who worry about irregular migration would think of when they read this. 900 million people in the world want to migrate. Indeed, the Gallup poll says 37% of the people in sub-Saharan Africa want to migrate, which is a huge number, almost 500 million people. Now, 500 million people in sub-Saharan Africa who might want to migrate. What is the reality of irregular migration into Europe from sub-Sahara Africa? Well, I give you the numbers for this year because now the article appears now, so it suggests this is a problem now, right? Uh-huh. This year, in the first 6 months of this year, the total number of people crossing to Italy in 6 months were 32,000, half of whom are not sub-Sahara Africa. The biggest group is Bangladesh. Then you have Pakistan, and then you have Egypt, and less than half are from sub-Saharan Africa, which means 15,000 sub-Saharan Africans in 6 months crossed to Italy irregularly. Add Spain, which is the second route, where it's been, again, a very, very small number, a few 10,000. And you add this up and you arrive at around 32,000 sub-Saharan Africans at most in 6 months. So you have this in the article suggestion, 900 million people, of which The majority, 500 million, are sub-Saharan Africans, want to migrate. That's why we need to change our asylum system, because the suggestion is they are the root cause of what we see as a migration crisis in Europe. But they aren't. People who want to migrate are not the people that have overwhelmed our asylum systems. There is almost no irregular migration, because honestly, if you add this up, you know, a few 10,000 a year, even if it would be 100,000 a year, and it won't be, but even if it would be 100,000 a year, as the complete total intercontinental irregular migration is a very low number. No, yeah. Why are our asylum systems struggling? It's because on the one hand, we have a lot, and this has been true in Germany, 10 years, Germany gave most protection, received over more than asylum applications per capita than its size in the EU. I mean, it's high, but it gave most protection in the EU by far. Germany and Austria together gave more than 50% of all positive asylum decisions. But they gave protection to Syrians. That's the number one group that got protection the last 10 years. And that is because there's been a civil war in Syria. So now, if you add to this other asylum seekers, those who don't get protection, most of those arrive in Europe legally. They fly in from South America to Spain. They don't come with boats. Right? Spain now has a lot of asylum applications from South America. But all of the Latin American countries, Central America, South America, all of them have the right, with the exception of Cuba, Bolivia, and I think Ecuador, but all the others, Colombia, Honduras, El Salvador, Venezuela, can travel visa-free to Europe. So this is really an issue of visa policy. Europe thinks it can cope with this. It allows people to travel freely. They fly into Spain, they apply for asylum.
Maybe just one quote also from the article. It says, which is sort of goes into the direction that you're arguing right now. So it says, and I quote, "In the past two decades, many have discovered that asylum offers a back door. Instead of crossing a border stealthily as in the past, they walk up to a border guard and request asylum, knowing that the claim will take years to adjudicate. And in the meantime, they can melt into the shadows and find work." I mean, this is sort of the argument you're making, but slightly different. Is this really the case also for Europe, or is this more of a case for instance, in the United States where these...
I mean, we can have a separate big discussion on the United States, but I'd like to focus on, on Europe now.
Let's focus on Europe, yeah.
Because The Economist comes out in London and in Europe, this is just not true. You know, people. First of all, people can't walk up to the door. They need to get into a boat. That's very, very dangerous. In fact, it's deadly. The crisis we have is that with the small numbers of irregular migrants from Africa, we have a lot of deaths. We have a lot of brutality. And my colleagues and myself have made proposals for 10 years how to indeed reduce and stop and control this irregular migration. But it's not helped by suggesting what the far right is claiming, that there is a huge wave of Africans just waiting to come, and we've seen them come, and there have been these sensationalist books about all of young Africa sitting on their suitcase. It's just not true. The numbers, The Economist could very easily check how many sub-Saharan Africans claiming that many want to migrate actually take this dangerous route. You know, if the total number of people crossing the major route into Europe, the Central Mediterranean route this year, is 32,000, one third of which are from Bangladesh. And it's very, very, and the number of Nigerians, which is the most populous country in Africa, the highest population in Africa. And the number of Nigerians who reach Europe at the moment each year is, you know, in the thousands. Uh-huh. I mean, it's below 5,000 a year. Crossing the Central Mediterranean, a country with, I don't know what the population is now, 220 million. You know, so what we are talking about is a complete distortion of our image, and asking people in Nigeria, would you like to migrate, doesn't tell you anything about the migration into rich countries, which is what this article is all about.
Yeah. Let's talk about the approaches or the sort of solutions that the article puts out there, some of which I think are quite interesting. And I think we should discuss all of them. But let's begin with sort of a point that you made a couple of minutes ago. And I quote the article, which states, "The most pragmatic approach would be to offer more refugees sanctuary close to home. Typically, this means in the first safe country or regional bloc where they set foot. Refugees who travel shorter distances are more likely one day to return home. They are also more likely to be welcomed by their hosts, who tend to be culturally close to them." I think that's also quite a controversial point, because it's also actually not quite true. But I further quote, "and to be aware that they are seeking the first available refuge from a calamity. This is why Europeans have largely welcomed Ukrainians. Turks have been generous to Syrians, and Chadians to Sudanese." So let's begin with this point, and then we'll talk about the sort of safe third country point next. But what do you say about this general approach to say, the system needs to focus on offering refugees sanctuary close to home, and that sort of solves the problem?
So few Africans, and that's why I insist on the number of who actually crosses into Europe. If so few people from Africa come to Europe, if we subtract Bangladeshis, who are not, obviously, most of them don't get asylum, they're not persecuted, they come to work in Italy. If we subtract them, then we see the obvious, that people who are in need of protection in Africa stay in Africa. I mean, that is the reality. That is happening today. It's a completely misleading picture that a large number of people in Africa in need of protection come to Europe. It is true that there are, I mean, the number two group this year crossing to Italy is Eritreans. And there is this issue that Eritrea is a brutal dictatorship with this forced labor system, where men might be drafted to work for the state, be in the military, stay for years. You know, there is an issue. But again, most Eritreans stay in Africa, most Eritrean refugees. So making this point, that is almost a description of what the system is now. Uh-huh. Now, let's go to the Syrians, because that's the most interesting question of refugees in Europe in the last 10 years. All of Europe took in 1.3 million Syrian refugees in 10 years. Turkey today has 2.8 million Syrians with temporary protection. So Turkey alone, a neighbor of Syria, has twice the number of Syrians that it gave a protection status, temporary protection, than the whole European Union with 450 million people. So you could say that indeed here too, it's the neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, where most Syrians have been hosted for the last decade or more. Uh-huh. Only a small number of the 6 million Syrian refugees, 1.3 million, made their way from Turkey to Europe. And so the question is, what is the region we are talking about? I mean, Turkey is a member of the Council of Europe. It's a European country. Politically, it's in all the European, you know, whether it's the European Soccer Association or the Eurovision Song Contest or the Council of Europe. It's a European country. It's a candidate for membership. Is Europe the region because Syria borders Europe? Well, in that case, you would say it's not surprising that some of those who reach Turkey move on. Now, how about the Afghans? That's more difficult, because that's also been a few hundred thousand in the last 10 years who crossed to Europe. Half of them got protection in Germany and Austria, again, in only two countries. Many of them have been in Iran. Iran is a country with, on paper, lots of refugees, but no policy of any integration. Recently, the Iranians claim that they discovered a huge increase of refugees who've been in the country the whole time. They did a new count. So they made themselves number one in terms of hosting refugees, but they don't do what the Turks do. They don't give a status with all rights, you know, with specific rights in Turkey, the right to send your children to a normal school, get access to healthcare, get some support. So some of them, seeing an opportunity in recent years, went on to Turkey. And then from Turkey, they went on to the European Union. Now, the vision again is, what is the region? Is Turkey part of the region to receive Afghans? Do you then say, yeah, but Turkey is part of the region, but you can't move on when Turkey is the country with most refugees in the world? So the issue, this sounds nice. The reality is most refugees stay in their region. Syrians just crossed from Syria into Turkey and then into the EU. You know, this wasn't a journey around the world. And of course, there are such cases. There are people, you know, from Bangladesh, from Eritrea, who make all their way to Libya to then get into Europe, to then go to Sweden. And so we think, yes, this phenomenon exists, but it's not. It's not numerically significant.
And so let's
say what's the positive in that vision. Of course, it does make sense to support countries of first reception. But how do we do that in Europe with the Ukrainians? So most Ukrainians have arrived in the Czech Republic, in Poland, in the Baltic states. You know, in the European Union, we made a joint decision to let all Ukrainians who can enter visa-free, they don't need smugglers, obviously, because they can just travel as tourists, they can return to Ukraine. But when they come and want to stay in Europe because of the war, they can automatically get a status. They can get the right to work, and they have access to healthcare and education. But there are still costs associated. You know, I mean, when you have a million Ukrainian refugees in Poland or 370,000 as in the Czech Republic. Well, in the European Union, surprisingly, we didn't actually create any system where parts of the European Union, which took the decision to let all the Ukrainians in, support other parts where most of them go. So we've created one really good system in recent years as part of the EU-Turkey statement 2016, the facility for the refugees in Turkey, where the European Union has been funding in a big way social support for Syrian refugees in Turkey. Many of them, half of them, get some cash every month from a program funded by the EU. That's useful. And there are smaller versions of this in other countries in the world. Yeah, that should be done. And there is too little of it. But that's not a reason to scrap the asylum system. And now we come to the major message of the article. The article, because it operates with these big numbers, suggests we are overwhelmed. And really, it should have divided the US debate from the European debate. Because in the US, you had huge numbers in recent years. And there is, as I said. But in Europe, the big numbers of refugees that a country like Germany has received are fundamentally because of the war in Syria and Putin's aggression against Ukraine. It's been two wars in the European neighborhood. And the image that the crisis of refugees and the challenge to asylum systems in Europe is created by lots of people who would like to migrate from poor countries knocking at our door and then coming in and claiming asylum is, in terms of the numbers, it's not that there aren't such cases, but it's a very misleading image. So that means, positively, that the system we have can be reformed. And I give you one more number, which is striking. And I wrote about it in a book I published in German, We and the Refugees, where I looked at Austria, small country, 9 million people, which had a prime minister, a chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, from 2017 until 2021, most of that time, who was very much in favor of reducing asylum applications and reducing irregular migration, closing routes for irregular migration. And in those 4 years, Austria gave protection, and Kurz, Sebastian Kurz, said he got the situation under control. So he said the crisis was over. And in those 4 years, Austria gave protection to 56,000 people. And I did the math. If you put this in per capita terms, in 4 years, if other European countries, only in the EU, would have given protection to as many refugees as Austria under Sebastian Kurz, who claimed it was not a crisis, in those 4 years, the EU would have given protection to 2.8 million refugees. If you add the UK, Switzerland and Norway, you end up with 3.3 million refugees just doing the Kurz standard. And if you add the OECD, you end up with, you know, adding Japan and the US and Canada. If they would have just done what Austria did under Sebastian Kurz.
Who was a restrictive chancellor.
Which was a restrictive chancellor. 18, 19, 20, 21. The OECD would have given protection to 8.5 million refugees. And if you then look at the refugee number in the world, you realize, because most people never cross the border who are displaced, you suddenly realize that the refugee problem, it really is a failure of the system. It really is a failure of creating legal routes, discouraging irregular routes, stopping the deaths. But it's solvable because the numbers are much, much smaller and more manageable with the right policy. So what The Economist is right in claiming is the current system is deadly, dysfunctional, and politically toxic because it has no control. Many people die and many people don't get protection. But where it is wrong is to say this is because of the refugee convention, the right to asylum, and the non-refoulement principle, which just says don't push people back into danger. That is not the problem. And so it's a wasted opportunity, a title that raises awareness of a big problem, but it provides the wrong numbers, the wrong analysis, and arrives at the wrong conclusions. And that's a pity because The Economist is a great paper, which I regularly read. It has great correspondence, and my recommendation would be to try again.
Except maybe let's take one sentence, which is, I think, the perfect transition for our second topic. We want to briefly talk about France and the UK. And I quote again, which I think you will hopefully agree with. I think this sentence is actually quite good, which says, if liberals do not build a better system, populists will build a worse one. And I think there's lots of truth in that. And I think that is a good way of transitioning to our next topic, which is of course the state visit of Emmanuel Macron in the UK, which happened last week. And as I mentioned, it was a historic one. Lots of niceties were shared, but actually there was also a pretty significant wide-ranging political decision. And I, to introduce this decision, I quote the UK Home Office here, which stated just a couple of days ago, the Prime Minister and French President Emmanuel Macron have agreed to take forward a groundbreaking partnership to address illegal channel crossings and dismantle the people smuggling networks. A new pilot scheme will see small boat arrivals being returned to France. Then an equal number of migrants will be able to come to the UK from France through a new legal route, fully documented and subject to strict security checks. Quote end. So we talked about this in our episode a couple of weeks ago, also in English for all our English viewers. If you want to check that episode out, please do. So now we know what has been discussed. We know the sort of deal that is on the table, the deal that has been agreed on. And I remember you saying that, you know, one of the dangers potentially was a sort of one-for-one deal, which would technically be a good start, but would not technically solve the entire problem. So where does this leave us now? What does this actually change, if anything at all? Is it just a good start and more things need to be done in order to make this a sophisticated agreement?
Yes. Well, to connect to what we've just discussed, the total number of crossings from Africa to Spain in the first 6 months of this year was 18,000. And Africa and Spain, as you know, has even some exclaves in Africa, North Africa, and the islands, the Canary Islands off the Atlantic coast of West Africa. 18,000. The total number of crossings from France to the UK this year, 6 months, was 20,000. So more people have left the EU with smugglers to the UK than have gone from Africa to Spain. And this shows us that this is not a very big number. But politically, it's a huge issue. In the UK, it's the number one issue that Nigel Farage and his Reform Party are using to accuse the government of incompetence, to say that the European Union is showing its true colors. You know, it's not helping. It's actually sending these people. It's not protecting its borders. And soaring in the polls. You know, recent polls have shown, I mean, the scenario where Nigel Farage might win a majority of the seats. In others, he's comes number one, not yet the majority, the absolute majority, but number one. What is also very striking is to see the lack of popularity of Labour, you know, of which won the last elections with a strong majority, but is under huge pressure. And a lot of this has to do with this sense that a central promise that the Conservative Party made in the previous government, that Labour made in this government, stopping those votes could not be met. And it's not about the size of the problem. It's 20,000 in 6 months. And it's not about asylum, because, of course, anybody can claim asylum in France. It's not a human rights issue at all. It's an issue of how do you stop irregular migration. This agreement goes a big step in accepting the core principles on which any solution must be based. First, the solution must be based on cooperation for Britain with an external country, and the obvious country is in the European Union, and France is a good start. I would argue strongly that Denmark, Germany, Sweden, the Benelux countries, Austria, Poland, all have an interest in this working, because all of these countries, just take Denmark, have a huge interest that the UK remains a committed member of NATO, remains a pro-European, a country with good relations with the EU. So, but France, okay, first start, France said we are willing to cooperate. Second, cooperation should be based on returning people who cross from a cutoff date. That was accepted. Yeah. Why? To make the crossings pointless. That is the message that we got from the governments. We want to show to people who are in the north of France or elsewhere in Europe, tempted to go to France, don't go there because you will be returned. Yeah. And then the fourth element in this. So, yeah, you need a partner. The obvious partner is in Europe. The numbers are not that high. You want to make crossings useless and futile. Is you also then say, well, we're also taking people from the European Union. So the UK doesn't shut itself off. I actually think for Labour voters, this is an important argument. Because even many Labour voters want control, but they don't want Britain to say, yeah, fine, now we are behind the European Union. People don't reach us anymore. We will not have many asylum claims. To organize it, to say people should be in an organized way, checked, there's no security risk, people are already in the European Union, the UK can in a resettlement program effectively, bring in people. Now we come to the problem. The problem is, now it must work. Now it was announced by the presidents of France, the president of France and the prime minister of the UK. It's a high-profile issue. Nigel Farage, of course, attacked the agreement. Boris Johnson said, it's all Macron's fault. He sends us these people, which is, of course, also ridiculous. France has more asylum applications per capita. No, in absolute terms and per capita than the UK. No, it's the right intuition. But now that they've announced it, they must make it work. And to make it work, two things are essential. It must really work quickly. So the details have not been published. I mean, there's been a lot of leaks. I know a few things from background talks, but they are still being worked on. And that's smart. When you announce that now it starts, everything should be in place to then, and this is what I recommend to everyone. And it's in the interest of the French, if they want this to work and not be a failure, to then say from now on, the UK is ready to detain anyone who crosses now. For a quick processing, they are talking about 2 weeks to check if you can return them to France. And France should say, from now on, we are ready to take everyone who crosses that the UK can send back legally. Because if you send a strong signal, and the fear I have is that the signal might be misunderstood at first, that the UK says, well, perhaps we just send a few percent of those who cross, then there is a risk that is a bit higher, like the risk of dying in the channel, which is also a risk. But it's not the message, it's not worth trying. Yeah. So the way it is organized, and this is open still, these are discussions going on in the background. I very much think it would be helping France a lot, if not Germany or Denmark, the EU presidency, which has very much been in favor of such agreements with other countries outside of Europe, come to the French and say, let's do it together. you know, it's not just return to France. They can, UK can also return a few people to Denmark, can also return a few people to Germany. The goal, of course, is that there will be very few returns after 2 weeks because it's credible. And so to go back to The Economist, the number one issue in the country where The Economist is based, that is really an issue of migration and irregular migration and smugglers, has nothing to do with asylum. You know, it's about if you cross to the UK, if nobody takes you back, you are there, even if you don't claim asylum. But it is a sign of a failure of a system because we are thinking the wrong way. We should strongly discourage irregular migration through working with partners, and we should encourage people who need protection that countries like the UK then say, listen, we're not taking one for one. We're going to take a larger number each year, the next 4 years, even once nobody crosses, because we think it's the right thing to do, but also because it creates a permanent interest in the European Union to keep this agreement alive. So a huge chance. The details need to be worked out, but it's a step in the right direction. I think one should congratulate the leaders to have the courage to cut this Gordian knot and now just hope that first others come and work with them on making this a success. And secondly, especially if they first try and it doesn't work quickly, that they realize if it works, it's because people believe crossing is futile. If it doesn't work, you need to make people believe that crossing from that point on is futile.
Yeah, that's a great point to make. And I mean, that is sort of, I think that the general argument that you are trying to make also with regard to other potential deals, like an EU-Turkey deal 2.0, I think that is the main argument that people need to understand. And I'm sometimes skeptical whether politicians have fully understood that is the direction they need to go into. And it leads us back to that one sentence in The Economist, which I think was very true, that if liberals, or you can call them liberals, Democrats, whatever you want to call them, if they don't create a system that functions, then there will be a worse one that is already being created as we speak by not only the populists of this world, but also by forces that have far worse things in mind than just populism. So I think that is the main message we wanted to bring across also with these two episodes that we did in English on this topic, because I think it is an important topic to discuss, because it shows in a relatively small area of this world how important these corporations are between countries. And as you rightly mentioned, Gerald, also if only the European Union were better at also distributing refugees, you mentioned the Austria example, then we would have far less problems. But it is also a problem of organization within the European Union, which obviously needs to be tackled as well. So thank you again for your expertise. Our next episode will be in German in the next couple of days, but be sure to check out our other English episode on this topic if you are interested. And thank you, Gerald, for your time today.
Looking forward to the next conversation in German and English. Goodbye. Ciao.
Me too. Have a nice day. Bye-bye.